1. The Accidental Actor. Look him in the eyes and really listen to what he's saying, Ronnie. Don't look at the bucket, my father said. He was prepping me for my first screen test. The bucket in question had come from my sandbox. Dad had drilled a hole in the bottom of it and knotted a rope through the hole so that he could tie the bright red bucket to the end of a broom handle, fashioning a homemade imitation of a boom microphone of that era. He did not want me to be distracted by the movements of the mic or of its operator during the screen test. A friend of Dad's swung the mic around our living room to simulate what I would soon experience. Another friend sat opposite me, serving as my dialogue partner. Dad thought I should get used to reading with a stranger. For good measure, my mother pretended to be a camera operator, using one hand to shine a desk light in my face and the other to hold a large cereal box, which represented a 35mm Mitchell camera. Dad left nothing to chance. At my audition the following day, I would be ready to comport myself before the MGM people in a professional manner. By the way, this was the fall of 1957. I was 3.5 years old. Mom and Dad, Gene and Rance Howard, never planned on being the parents of child actors. They harbored no Barrymore-like expectations of founding an acting dynasty. We lived in a modest walk-up in Queens during the golden age of live television. Dad was struggling to make ends meet as an actor himself. Mom had a steady job working as a typist for CBS. Dad's biggest break to date was a small part in the touring production of the Tony Award-winning play Mr. Roberts, whose original Broadway star, Henry Fonda, still held the title role. My father gained not only the experience of working with first-rate actors, but also the clout to direct summer stock productions of the show. During one of these productions, somewhere in Maryland in the summer of '57, Dad noticed my aptitude for acting. While the actors rehearsed on stage in an outdoor theater surrounded by open fields, I sat alone in the first row of seats observing. Rather quickly, I picked up the dialogue and started repeating it back to Dad at home, much to his amusement. Soon we worked out a routine. He played Lieutenant Roberts, the Fonda part, if you've seen the movie, and I played Ensign Pulver, the Jack Lemmon part. Roberts, Dad. Whatever happened to those marbles you were going to put in the captain's overhead so they'd roll around all night and keep him awake? Pulver, me, glowering. Now you've gone too far. Now you've asked for it. Rattling an imaginary canister full of marbles. What does that look like? 5 marbles. I got another one in my pocket. 6 marbles. I'm looking for marbles all day long. Consider the visuals. My dad, a grown man, engaged in an intense conversation with a 40-pound pipsqueak with freckles and red hair who wore a striped T-shirt, shorts, and blue kids. We turned this scene into a little parlor trick that we performed for Mom and Dad's friends in New York, where it always brought down the house. Little did we know that my Ensign Pulver bit would serve as my first audition material. In those days, a hustling actor like Dad had to physically make the rounds of the casting agencies, all concentrated in a cluster of buildings in Midtown Manhattan. As a matter of routine, my father went from one casting director to the next, dropping off a resume and a headshot, reading for whoever would hear him. One day, Dad poked his head into the office at MGM, where he knew the casting director, only to discover a waiting room jam-packed with little kids. This gave him an idea. He said to the receptionist, "Tell them that Rance Howard stopped by and that, by the way, I have a son who's a fine actor." He left our phone number, not with any great expectations, just as an extra flourish that would make his message stand out from the others. But they did call the next day, asking Dad if he could bring his little boy in. Next thing I knew, I was performing my Ensign Pulver set piece for MGM's casting director. I'm told that I slayed, though I honestly don't remember. They asked Dad if I was capable of doing anything else. To his credit, he confessed that he honestly didn't know. That's when they gave me a new scene to learn and scheduled me for a screen test for a movie called The Journey. I recall little of our time in Queens, just some sketchy details, a butcher store down the street, a neighbor kid whose house I played at when my parents needed a babysitter, a snowman that Dad built in our little patch of yard by piling snow into a yellow plastic trash container and flipping it over. The screen test prep is the one thing I remember vividly. Dad coaching me about working with his actor friend, saying, "Look him in the eyes. Stay focused. Really listen to what he's saying." The bucket on the broomstick, the lamplight in my face, it sounds intense, like Earl Woods trying to shake the teenage Tiger Woods concentration by trash-talking him on his backswing. My father was gentler, though. More like Obi-Wan schooling Luke Skywalker in the ways of the Force. In my case, the Force was a simplified preschooler's version of the method. The set of acting techniques developed by the Russian theater guru Konstantin Stanislavski and practiced by such actors as Marlon Brando, James Dean, and Paul Newman. Dad embraced the method's emphasis on emotional sincerity, the idea of putting yourself in the character's shoes while channeling your own feelings. He never nudged me to do anything performative in a cute kid kind of way, like flash a big smile or pull a goofy oops face. He simply told me to stay present in the scene, to take it moment by moment. Not until I was an adult did I appreciate how radical this approach was for a child actor. Dad never once talked down to me or treated me as a performing seal. Other kids, I would discover when we moved to California, were not so lucky. They were their parents' meal tickets. But when I went out for auditions with Dad at my side, he put no pressure on me to win the part. He focused on execution, not in results. "If I just concentrated," he said as we practiced in the apartment, "I would grasp the essential logic of the scene, and the performance would take care of itself." This was my first and most important acting lesson, and in many ways it remains the foundation of my creative process to this day. When I walked onto a soundstage for the first time the following day to audition for The Journey, I saw real lights, a real boom mic, and a real camera. The assistant director instructed me to step onto a T-mark on the floor, something I hadn't practiced in Queens, but none of it threw me. I was new at this, but honestly, I felt pretty comfortable, like I already belonged. And my comfort and preparation paid a huge dividend. I got the part. The Journey was a Cold War drama directed by Anatole Litvak. I played the son of two Americans trying to flee communist Hungary. E.G. Marshall and Ann Jackson played my character's parents. Yul Brynner and Deborah Carr reunited for the first time since The King and I led the cast, which also included Jason Robards in his feature film debut. 31 years later, I directed Jason in my film Parenthood. We kidded about how we broke into the business together. Principal photography for The Journey was to take place in Vienna, a beautiful setting for a young kid's first paying job. Better still, Mom and Dad were coming with me, compliments of MGM. The studio made a family deal, casting my father in a bit part and hiring my mother as my official on-set guardian. For my parents, this stroke of good fortune presented itself as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. They were too poor to even contemplate a European vacation, and my paychecks would be set aside and earmarked for college. No one in the Howard family thought of The Journey as anything but a one-off for me as an actor. In the spring of 1958, we took off from Idlewild Airport for Europe, a first for all of us. We stopped in Shannon Airport in Ireland so the ground crew could refuel our propeller plane. While we bided our time in the terminal, the Irish airport workers took notice of my red hair and teased me affectionately. "You look like you've come home, lad," they said. "You shouldn't really be getting back on that plane, should you?" But get back on the plane we did. On March 3rd, just 2 days after my fourth birthday, we landed in Austria. The final descent was glorious, with Vienna resplendent in a blanket of newly fallen snow. The journey is a heavy picture. A bunch of international travelers, including my character, are trying to flee Budapest by bus during the Hungarian Revolution of 1956, only to be detained by a fearsome Soviet commander, played by Brenner. To me, though, the whole experience was pure joy, a stress-free first job. When I wasn't in a scene, I climbed up onto the army tanks that guarded the film's Soviet checkpoint. The film's prop master gave me a wheelo, that little toy with a spoked wheel that rolls along both sides of a magnetic metal track, which kept me mesmerized for hours. The wardrobe people dressed me up in a smart plaid jacket with matching ear flap cap. I loved this outfit for how cool it made me look, even though the accompanying scarf itched my neck. When the shoot was over, my pragmatic Oklahoman parents, believing this trip to be the only chance they would ever have to visit Europe, piggybacked some vacation travel onto our stay in Europe. We toured Venice, Paris, and London. My favorite part, though, was directly tied to the work. In a pivotal scene in the journey, Yul Brynner's character, Major Surov, intimidates the hell out of his captives by taking a bite out of the shot glass from which he's drinking vodka. Yul, with his shaved head and severe features, looked convincingly fearsome in his Soviet officer's uniform. But he was a kind and gregarious man who noticed that I was fascinated by the scene and didn't want me to get any dangerous ideas. So between takes, he invited me to sit in his lap. He held the prop glass to my face. "Taste this, Ronnie," he said. "This is sugar, not real glass. It's pretend, for the movie. You would never bite real glass." He encouraged me to chomp on a little shard. It tasted just like rock candy. Whoa. I thought, this is amazing. This marked the beginning of my fascination with the process of how stories are told on the screen. I had learned a secret of the trade. I was in on the magic trick, and wow, did I like being in on the magic trick. The Journey wrapped in June 1958 and came out to good reviews the following year, but it wasn't a game changer for the Howard family. After we returned to New York, I settled back into my preschool routine. Mom resumed her typing duties at CBS, and Dad continued to go out on auditions without much success. TV acting work in New York had pretty much dried up by then. As the 50s came to an end, so too did the golden age of live television, most of it shot on the East Coast. Dad's agent suggested that he move west, to Los Angeles, where a raft of new detective shows and westerns were in production. When your own agent tells you to move, that's a pretty good sign that it's time to get out of town. So in the summer of 58, we packed up the old Plymouth, bade farewell to Queens and my parents' New York friends, and pointed the car in the direction of California. The journey was my breakthrough, but this cross-country drive marked the beginning of my real journey.